first though, the God list.
Oh, that's okay. You can put it in after.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my father, with a couple of Caucasian people, went drilling for oil in Long Beach and for about a year. And all they got out of it was salt water and a little bit of oil.
Oh.
They didn't hit it in oil. Mm-hmm. But, so my father's always mixed a lot of business with Caucasian people. And in turn, you know, I got to meet a lot of them. And he'd always encouraged me to go and meet people and do things with other people. And he always had Caucasian people visiting him in Chinatown, and he would take them out to dinner. My father was a great banquet organizer. Every time somebody had a wedding or a banquet or something traditionally Chinese, they would always come to him to ask him to set up the banquets.
Mm-hmm.
And he would know where to get the best banquet chef. Because in Chinese, you have a regular chef who works in restaurants, but you also have a banquet chef.
Mm-hmm.
And a banquet chef is not like an ordinary cook in a restaurant. You hire him for 2 or 3 days, you give him so much money to buy the food, and he'll give you a menu, or you work out a menu with him, and he cooks for 2 or 3 days for so many $1,000s and feed maybe 100 people or whatever. And he'll cook the most super cuisine in the world. Like one time, one of my father's friends, a gambler, won a lot of money, and he wanted a banquet for 3 continuous days. And they ordered a turtle from the Galapagos Islands, a live turtle that was 500 pounds.
Oh my goodness.
And I saw the turtle shipped in, and they rented a restaurant in First Street. They shut the place down, and there was 3 groups of friends that came from 3 days. The first day, only his most personal friends were invited for that dinner. The second day was the in-between middle friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the third day are people who are just casual friends,
mm-hmm,
would come for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But the first day was for the exclusive and the private, personal family. And he gave gifts to everybody, and in the tradition of Chinese gamblers, you have to give 10% of your winnings in the form of gifts, or otherwise the god of gambling put the hex on you,
mm-hmm,
that you'll never win again. So it's kind of a nice tradition, because then they always buy dinners and give gifts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my father ordered a Galapagos turtle and a couple of 100 pounds of herbs. And they cooked that thing for 2-3 days. And then they served it as part of the main soup course in the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
They start that as part of the first course of dinner. And that chef cooked 3 different dinners in the 3 different days. Complete different menus.
That's amazing.
And this is some of the things that my father used to do. And it got to be very boring, because once a month you go to these restaurants and eat real exotic cuisines, you know, Chinese cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun, because looking back at it, I'd never be able to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know anybody who's a banquet chef, and I don't know anybody who cooks that well.
Right.
And some of the food that my father had was real exotic. And like going to eat rattlesnake steaks and things. I mean, he had a very adventurous person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only because, I guess, you know, you come from China, and you learn all these things, and you read about it, and then they always used to come to him for advice in that form. So I got the benefit of going to eat exotic dinners and things, and,
uh-huh,
and listen to Chinese banquets and things like that. And
how about in recreation? Did you do Chinese things, or family life, you know, playing games and whatever?
In Chinese family, we didn't go out anywhere. In other words, a typical Chinese going on, like Chinese New Year, would be, you know, banquet food and Chinese special dishes and things, and Chinese presents and your tangerines and the altar to the gods, and the burning of papers and all that, and the candy fruit and all that. I mean, that's traditional. Then cleaning up the house, you know, so that the house is clean on New Year's. Things like that was the tradition. And then you either go out to eat in a Chinese restaurant or eat at home. And if your family, you eat at home. As far as recreation, we just had, like sometimes friends would come and they play mahjong all night, smoke and drink and eat, you know, suya and things like that, midnight snack. And they would order food from the restaurant, a midnight snack. And there was always a restaurant in Chinatown that would be open 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you're never without a place to eat.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that they would have card games or mahjong and a lot of food and tea and things like that. But as far as entertainment, other than having a radio, that was the only outside communication. And the other is that in Chinatown, one of the strange things, we never had a American newspaper. That was the other Chinese for China kind of a thing. We had Chinese newspapers, but we never had the LA Times or the Examiner.
Did you know of many family or any families that...
In Chinatown, none of them bought an American paper.
Yeah.
It was being a snob if you were, you know, like, gee, you're so good, you think you're so good that you buy an American paper.
Uh-huh.
So my father never bought an American paper.
Hmm.
And my brother and I used to have to go to the restaurant around the corner to read the American paper or the funnies.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it's that thing about being, if you're part of the community in Chinatown, you didn't go this American bit. But my father was always pushing me out to the outside so that you meet the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And you play in sports and things. In the old days, Chinese never promoted sports or outside activities.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a lot of spare time, you're supposed to study. Not to go out dances or parties or anything like that. In fact, there was no such thing as dances in Chinatown. But the young people was to mix up and have parties and social. There was no such thing like that in the 30s at least. It changed after the 50s. Then.
Did you go to Chinese operas and movies?
I did with my father.
Mm-hmm.
And sit there and eat watermelon seeds and moi and things like that. Yeah, I did go to a few of those, but not that often.
And did you read Chinese books or novels and practice calligraphy, do things like that at home?
Yeah,
outside
at home.
of Chinese school time?
Practice your Chinese school, yeah.
Yeah.
You had to because it was just hard.
Mm-hmm.
But and then also do your American studies as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, my father didn't really not push it to the point where you had to get very good grades in Chinese. It was just more important that you have a Chinese background.
Mm-hmm.
You could speak it and read it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't, before that, it was very important that you could read and write Chinese and be very Chinese. But later on, I guess he realized that in the American circle, you're going to have to be a good American educated person as well. And not as important as in the Chinese, only that if you could speak and read and get along in the outside Chinese circle, that was good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Not to get A's and B's, and, you know, in other words, it wasn't a grade thing, it was more to sit you in a Chinese environment until it sinks in.
Mm-hmm.
That was more important.
Mm-hmm. Did you, the Chinese boys ever organize any sports groups?
Yes. In the Chinese group in Chinatown, they formed the first Chinese Boy Scout group. Stanford Mew is one that I readily remember being one of the people that was in this Chinese Boy Scout group, and it was a very good group. They did exceptionally well in competition with the American Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
And they were always above average, and their spirit of being as a cohesive unit was really great because they did themselves real proud and they excelled in everything. Not because they were all Chinese, but the fact that they were all Chinese and they were the first Chinese Boy Scout troop.
When was that started?
This was back in 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I ever saw a Chinese Boy Scout group in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
This is an old Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that time my brother was in they formed the first Chinese tennis group. That's, now when I go back on that, that's with the group who were going to college in the 30s to 39s to 1940. That age group coming out of college had formed the first Chinese tennis club. Walter Lee is one of the top players mm-hmm. at that time. My brother and my sister-in-law, Betty Tong.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Maywa drum corps, which was a Chinese girl drum and bugle corps.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was in a Chinese basketball team with Doc Wong and Walter and David and that group. They formed a basketball team that played in Calexico, Mexicali, and San Diego, and all the way up to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was my brother is 6'2", and there was another David Dong's Dong family. David Dong's Frank Dong. He's also 6 feet, and my wife's cousin Clarence is 6 feet. At one time, there was about 3 Chinese 6-footers,
mm-hmm.
and there was a man by the name of Doc Wong, who's a doctor in Fresno. He's also 6'2".
Mm-hmm.
Out of a bunch of low Chinese,
right.
that in those days,
uh-huh.
when you get 4 Chinese that are in the 6-foot bracket, they literally wiped out everybody. It was kind of a strange, freaky circus
right.
group, you know, but really they were just a group of talented players that was invited up and down the coast to play basketball, and they beat everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Only because they were so darn tall. The average Chinese was like 5'6", 5'7". These guys were 6 feet.
Yeah.
So we did have organized sport in that sense. In my group, in the 40s and 50s, we had basketball teams that, like, I was in the basketball team in Chinatown in the Catholic group, and that's with people like Stanford and Mankong Chuck. And Raymond Chi and people like that, that all went to Chinese school in Chinatown. And
mm-hmm.
this was a Cathedral High School, and the Catholic Father formed a basketball team and a baseball team and a track team and a football team, and it's
mm-hmm.
out of that Chinese school
mm-hmm.
environment.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Father had formed dances and social dances on weekends and things like that. And the competition was that the other Chinese families that had migrated out of Old Chinatown, that was down on Presbyterian 20th Street, down
mm-hmm.
in San Pedro,
mm-hmm.
they also had a group down there that formed a basketball team. And the Presbyterian Church down in that area had a Chinese school as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there was enough young people there that formed the basketball team. So there was like... 1, 2, 3, 4. I can remember 4 to 5 Chinese basketball teams. Ours was the Catholic group, and there was the ones down. Frank Kwan was in this other one that was always in competition with us. And most of the Chinese kids in the high schools that we went to, one was Polytechnic High, which is what I went to. That serviced that area in the 20th and San Pedro area. Belmont High was the school that I was supposed to go,
mm-hmm.
and that serviced the Chinatown area.
Mm-hmm.
These two high schools was where the greatest amount of Chinese was to be found.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, those were the only two Chinese high school areas
mm-hmm.
that you find most of the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's different. Now Marshall High School, Lincoln, and a lot of the outer reaches of high schools are beginning to have more Chinese because the colony is much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Before, there wasn't any more than maybe 30,000-40,000 Chinese, and up to about 50,000-60,000 after the Second World War. And the reason for that was that in my brother's age group, in the college age where you graduate in the 30s, a Chinese would never marry any other person but a Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't very many Chinese girls.
Mm-hmm.
There was few, but not enough to go around to all the men.
Mm-hmm.
And to marry a Japanese or any other would be second class. You would insult your family's name, all the other problems. And they wouldn't accept you.
Mm-hmm.
So it was rather difficult. So a lot of the Chinese had to go back to China to get married. But during the Second World War, Chinese were not able to go back to China to get married. So some got married after the Second World War, which was in the 1949s and 1950s. After that situation, when the Korean War came in 1950-51, the concept of having a son in the family, in the Chinese circle, was nice, and that was a tradition. But they found that most of the sons that were draft age, a lot of them got killed or wounded. And it wasn't that great to have a son and to bring him up to that age and then have him killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a real second thinking of the Chinese families, that it wasn't that great to have all sons and then have them go to war and die. That was kind of a hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, and because of also not having enough Chinese girls around to be of, you know, marriage age to the young men here, some of the Chinese kids, at least my age group, started to marry out of the Chinese circle, married Japanese girls,
mm-hmm.
which is a real no-no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was even worse than marrying a Caucasian, I think. But the thing was, by then their fathers were in their 65s and 70s. They weren't so ornery and they weren't so pushy.
Mm-hmm.
And to the mothers, it was, what the heck, that's an Oriental.
Uh-huh.
They could have married a black or brown or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so the color lines started to break. And the Japanese girls were just as acceptable, if not prettier, and just as nice. And so in my age group, a lot of them broke the barrier line.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other families that was the ones that held off, you know, that wouldn't allow their kids to marry outside of that circle of just Chinese, finally relented and broke down. And that's why there's now a lot of Chinese and Japanese intermarried. And but in Hawaii, it was already done. It was just a matter of fact. It was just in the western San Francisco and L.A. that you don't marry anything but Chinese. And if you didn't marry, your father would send for a picture bride. And even to 1950s, even my friend Ed Sam in San Francisco, his father's still alive, and he had the first cowboy shirt factory in Los Angeles. He's in his 90s right now. Mm-hmm. And he used to service celebrities like Tom Mix and Wild Bill Hickok and all these, Butch Cassidy and Hopalong Cassidy and people like that. He was a Chinese who came over with nothing and is a millionaire now. And all his family and children are up north in San Francisco.
Is he still living in L.A.?
No, he's in San Francisco.
Oh, uh-huh.
And he's another one that is an exceptional person. That where he's located, where his store was right next to the Overa Street. Overa Street.
What's his name?
Calvin Sam.
Uh-huh.
S-A-M-N.
Mm-hmm.
His son is Edwin Sam, and he's my age.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes down about once or twice a year at the most.
Mm-hmm.
And he left here when he was 18.
Mm-hmm.
That goes way back to 1946 or 47, around that time when they had back here.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of families left for different parts of this area. Like some went to the valley in, you know, Canoga Park and places like that, and started up a new lifestyle. And some have gone out to Orange County. But old Chinatown is most of the people that I know went actually directly back into China City and Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they first started to break this line of marriage. And until, for a while, they were able to go back to China and marry a Chinese girl. But for a while, they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And when they didn't, they just didn't get married. So there was a kind of a low Chinese population.
Do you think Samyup preferred to marry Samyup Chinese and Sayup married Sayup? And was there any breakdown in that,
yeah,
in those lines?
There was. A samyak will not marry a seyak.
Will not go down.
No, there was no down. Yeah, that's true. And also, there was a such thing as, and I didn't understand this until my father explained it to me. If your family is a business family, you don't marry a girl who's from the farm.
Uh-huh.
That's another one of those taboos.
Yeah.
In other words, if your family is an aristocrat family,
uh-huh.
you don't allow your son to marry a daughter who's from the farming family, even though the farming family are rich.
Yeah.
Even though that's the only daughter and she's richer than heck, you don't marry her.
Mm-hmm.
You, it's all right to bring her to visit, and they're friendly and
mm-hmm.
very much that, but they'll tell the son, no, you can't marry her.
Mm-hmm.
She's not in our class.
Mm-hmm.
That, I can remember some of that in the 30s.
So you had to marry within your class and within your
rank
and within your dialect too,
yes.
perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah. But then what about American-borns marrying those from, you know, China?
It didn't matter.
Well, you were saying before that, you know, some of your friends would tease you for, you know, playing or hanging around with,
yes.
with
yes.
people from China. So what if you took you took a Chinese bride, you know, from China or something?
As you got older, as we got to be 18, 19, and 20, that was not much of a thing. It was in that part where you were between 12, 13, 14, when you were in your teens, that's when it made a lot of social pressures.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
When you got into upper high school,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't that much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was just in that teen period that there was a lot of class distinctions and things like that. And it was kind of strange because I used to question it with my dad, why they do that, you know. And he used to tell me that, at least what he learned and his philosophy of friends is that when you make a friend, you should never abandon your friend. Now the reason for this is that, he said, it doesn't sound right maybe and it may not be true, but these are some of the reasons. Don't ever say a bad word to your friend. Hold your tongue. Why? How long did it take you to be a friend? It took you 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years or more. To be a friend is that you have to trust him in total. He in turn trusts you in total. You have mutual interests that you slowly develop into a very close kinship, friends, better than even a brother. Because he did something bad to you and you suddenly popped off and said, oh, I hate you because you did this to me or something. You break a friendship because you suddenly lost your cool. You've lost 10 years of a working friendship. You
mm-hmm.
work your way to trust and friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And because you spouted off in a time of pressure or patience, that you destroy a 10-year friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he says that's an awful foolish thing. And the reason for being foolish is that you didn't pay him to be your friend. He didn't pay you to be your friend.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of trust and time. So to destroy a friendship by not being patient and not being understanding, you're not really a friend. So in generating friends, even if your friend went to jail because he killed somebody, or he stole something, or he's the biggest thief in town, you don't abandon him for social contacts. Your friend tells you to abandon that person as a friend because he's a crook and a thief and a bad guy. You don't listen to your friends to abandon him, because after all, he was a friend to you before he was a crook,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't question him. So later on in life, he became a crook,
mm-hmm.
and a notorious crook.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't abandon him.
Mm-hmm.
After all, he is your friend,
mm-hmm.
and he did no wrong to you. So you should never judge him you should never be a judge of a person who's a friend. You take him for what he is.
Mm-hmm.
Good, bad, indifferent. When he's rich, he does nice things to you. Then when he's poor, you say he's no longer your friend because he's not taking you out to dinner and such. That's not friend. Mm-hmm. You're being an opportunity taker, and you're greedy. You're a wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
So with that kind of thing, my father showed me that you make friends because people happen to like you. And for people to like you, you cannot buy. All the gold in China could not buy friendship.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you don't ever judge anybody. You don't listen to your friends. A friend is not a friend who says to you, you're going out with that Chinese fresh off the boat guy. and your friend says, why are you going with that square person? Well, you don't need to explain. I mean, you're embarrassed and you're feeling kind of, you don't know which way to turn. And he says, don't ever listen to him. Just listen to what you, if you think that's a good friend, you enjoy him. He'll enjoy you. Of course, if he punch you in the face or something like that, well, then it's up to you to decide whether you still want to be his friend. You might still want to.
Mm-hmm.
But don't ever judge a friend by other people saying that that's not your friend. And if I'm a friend, and if you want me as a friend, you have to abandon that. Then as he says, you might have to tell that friend who put that proposition to you that you're not much of a friend to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the reason why you want me to abandon the other, because he said it's very hard to collect friends. True friends.
Mm-hmm.
True friends are people that don't. They like you for who you are. They enjoy you. They enjoy being around you.
Mm-hmm.
They invite you. With all the money in the world, you couldn't invite all these people to be your friends. And if they wait until you're rich to enjoy you as a friend, then I wouldn't. They are not your friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you're poor that you have friends.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you're rich, then you should be nice to them too. I mean, in other words, you should reciprocate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when I started to understand what friends are all about.
Mm-hmm.
Just because these are fresh off the boat,
right,
and they can't speak, and they're kind of country clots,
mm-hmm,
it's not my rights to judge what they are, what they like, and their mannerisms, and you should appreciate them.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't feel sorry for them either.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to change them, because you're liable to louse up their mental balance of what right and wrong is. You know, they're always worried that, oh, is my tie on right? Is my combination of colors on right? Well, you know, who are you to say that that's wrong? That's wrong food to eat. That's wrong spoon or fork.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your rights.
Mm-hmm.
But as a friend, you do have the choice of saying, oh, you don't go up and hug that girl because, you know, I mean, you don't do that. In other words, you do things like that. But he says, you just don't. You have no rights, and people should not indulge in telling you how to do things. And you should never, you can accept it, but you should just accept it, listen, be courteous, and then evaluate yourself, and then do what you have to do is right.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, then you're not a doer, you're just a follower.
So was your father particular at all about who you were going to marry?
Actually, when I was at that age,
Oh, you said he passed away when you were 18.
Yeah, when I was 18.
Okay. Well,
when I was about 15 or 16, he talked about it a little bit. Not really who my friends were or who, what am I going to, you know, who am I going to marry or whatever, no. He never, ever...
Did he ever say Japanese or Caucasians were out of the question?
No, because some of our best friends were Japanese, even during the Japanese War. We had a funny thing going. We had a family by the name of Tenji. He's Chinese, and she's Japanese.
Uh-huh.
They had a barber shop in Chinatown, and I used to have my hair cut there.
Mm-hmm.
And one weekend, I was very little at that time, they invited me as an overnight guest at their house. And their house was done in the Japanese style. That hot baths,
mm-hmm,
you sleep on the floor,
mm-hmm,
and you change over to the Japanese bathrobes.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And he speaks Chinese and Japanese. And she speaks Japanese and English, a little bit of broken English. And he speaks to me in Chinese, and she speaks to me in a little bit of halting Chinese. During the time when we had the Second World War, all the Japanese was interned at this camp. For 3 months, they were trying to find Tenji and his wife, because she's Japanese and he's Chinese,
right.
And she had to be interned as a possible spy or whatever. They were cutting people's hair in Chinatown, totally in the open, in the barbershop. And every time this Caucasian guy, FBI, comes in and says, "Do anybody know Mr. Tenji? We're here to pick up his wife and him and take him to the internment camp." There they are, right there, cutting hair. And everybody in Chinese were in there saying, "Don't talk to that white devil, you know, this. Don't even answer him."
Yeah.
And everybody saying, "No, we don't know who Tenji is. Who's he?" "Oh, we don't have any Japanese here. Everybody's Chinese." And here's this Japanese wife is there cutting everybody's hair.